everyone. I'm Manisha, and this is Teach Your Kids. We are a show where we help parents learn how to curate their children's education as a supplement or replacement to traditional school. And today I have with me Rachel Thomas. Welcome, Rachel.
Oh, thank you, Manisha. Thanks for having me.
So Rachel's one of the smartest people I know, and so I feel so fortunate that you're here. She is the co-founder of Fast.ai, which created the most popular deep learning course in the world, was selected by Forbes as one of the 20 incredible women in AI. She was founding director of the University of San Francisco Center for Applied Data Ethics. She has a PhD in math from Duke and was an early engineer at Uber, and she's currently pursuing a master's in immunology. And so I know Rachel because we have been raising a child together for 3 years. Actually, I exaggerate. Rachel and I have been collaborating on her wonderful child's education and have become friends in the process. So Rachel, I guess I just want to start off with, did you ever think in a million years that you'd be homeschooling today?
No, I never expected to be homeschooling. I actually had a positive view of homeschoolers just because I know several homeschoolers with PhDs who have done very well. But I just the time commitment seemed huge. My husband Jeremy and I are both pretty career focused, and I had never thought that we would have the time to homeschool. And also, I was just so unaware of kind of how many online resources there are now.
Excellent. Yeah. And you've actually applied a lot of the online resources in your own homeschooling.
Yes, definitely.
So how did that process happen? What made you and your husband decide to take the leap and homeschool your daughter?
Yeah, so it was the pandemic. We weren't planning on doing this. So kind of going back to before the start of the pandemic, our daughter was in a full-time Montessori preschool. She was 4 and a half, and we were both working full-time. And yeah, and then kind of with the shutdown, we had her at home. And something I'm really glad that we did is, Jeremy was like, we should assume that we have no childcare for at least the next year to 18 months. Like, we really need to get into a routine of what kind of how we're going to do this. But yeah, fortunately, we came in contact with Manisha. Yay. And our daughter really, really thrived in that first year at home. A key thing that we were doing is we were not trying to replicate in-person school at all. Which I really, really think makes a difference, because I know a lot of schools and a lot of families, I think, had trouble in part because they were trying to kind of replicate an in-person school at home. So we had a really, really great experience. Not sure how much detail I should go into at this point.
As much as you think would be relevant.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. So then we actually moved to Australia. We'd been living in San Francisco prior to this. And we actually considered continuing to homeschool because it was working, but we ended up just kind of being, in this totally new place. We decided to put our daughter in school in order to kind of help, better integrate into the community. And the school we sent her to, like, it was a good school. And so I feel kind of fortunate that, like, it's not that we had this, like, terrible school experience. But it was still, it was kind of meh for her. A few issues. She had ended up unintentionally kind of very, very accelerated from the year of homeschooling. So she was really advanced. And the school actually really tried to work with her on this, but it just, it's really hard with a class of 20 students to accommodate kind of where each student is. And even they actually let her join a math class that was several years beyond her grade level. But even then, the pace was too slow for her. So she did well socially, but she was becoming more withdrawn, more passive, more disengaged. So she's in school, I guess, about 8 months. And then we kind of, not connected to the school situation, but just, the first Omicron wave, kids in Australia hadn't been vaccinated yet. This was prior, kind of they were on a later schedule than the US. So initially we were just going to take her out of school for 3 months. And then we immediately kind of saw her switch back. Like once we got her back into kind of her online, and online we were doing very small group classes. So, you know, her and her best friend is also homeschooled and a tutor. And that kind of engagement you can get in that small group, kind of direct attention. She just became so much more curious and engaged again, and her appetite for kind of making mistakes and taking risk increased. And so we saw a lot of really positive changes. And so we ended up not sending her back to school as we had planned.
Wow. So one of the things that I think was really interesting about the way you chose to homeschool when you first started in the pandemic is that a lot of your daughter's education was online. And I was really, you know, I mean, as you know, I'm not hiding it. When you came to me and said, I'd like her to do 6 or 7 hours a day of online classes, I just felt like this was a horrible, horrible idea, you know, and I can tell you now, you know, because, you know, I've come with you on this journey. I'm like, this poor child is going to be sitting in front of her computer for 7 hours a day. Like, what is wrong with this family? Like, I don't know what is going on, but you know what? You convinced me.
Do we really put those 7 hours?
So here's what happened. The truth comes out. No, so my views on screen time have changed completely due to the two of you. But, you know, my original plan for the company was that we would have 2 hours of social time a week where the kids would interact and then 1 hour of, you know, check-ins with a teacher, see how everything was going. And we would like offer curriculum stuff. And then Jeremy said to me, well, you know, we have to work. So would it be possible if you would have, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day? And then we have a class with our Spanish, you know, childcare provider who also does art in the afternoon. So I felt like, okay, what? And then what happened is that Jeremy kind of showed me how he was doing these classes, which is that it wasn't sitting in front of a screen. It was, you know, jumping around. And, you know, we were collaborating together to kind of get this great setup so that your daughter was able to move freely around her room, and we had a camera that followed. And so it ended up being something much more physically active than sitting in a traditional school.
Maybe I should back up and say kind of what we were doing before.
Yes, let's back up, because what I think is trying to flush out here is your views on screen time, because they're quite revelatory.
And we can go back to
take it back.
I have made a bunch of big moves kind of around the U.S. Basically, ever since I turned 18, I grew up in Texas, and then I went to undergraduate in Philadelphia, and I did my PhD in North Carolina. I moved back to Philadelphia. I moved to San Francisco. And so I'm very used to having close friends that I talk to by phone. And so I should say that, like, for me, like, long-distance friendships and long-distance relationships have always felt kind of every bit as real as people that, you know, you could see in person. And then my husband and I are both computer nerds. And so we do spend a lot of time online. And my husband in particular, Jeremy, has had, you know, a lot of really close collaborations that grew, you know, through open source software, often with people he had never met in person, but was working closely with. And so we've never lived in the same state as either of our families. And so even prior to the pandemic, my daughter was really used to, like, oh, we talk to the grandparents on Skype, like, and that's kind of a really important avenue for those relationships. And so kind of going into with the stay at home and the start of the pandemic, we were both trying to work. And so we set it up in a very relational way, but we tried to kind of have the day of, like, okay, you know, this is the hour where you talk to grandma on Skype. And as she said, like, this was very, like, you know, my daughter was 4 and a half. And so she was still at a point where it's like, oh, I want to play Frozen and dance for grandma, or, you know, like, act out a story with my stuffed animals. And so it was, could be quite physical or playful, or, you know, like, I'm building blocks and, you know, showing that. Then we lined up. So it was grandma, her best friend who had lived in our neighborhood, And this was, you know, San Francisco, everyone was really, really staying home. They were doing online play dates. And again, they might, you know, play music together and, you know, have this element of co-playing. And so, and then, yes, we had had a nanny from when our daughter was little who, and she had kind of already moved on to another job prior to the pandemic. But we ended up hiring her to Skype with our daughter every day. And she would, she was fantastic, would find, you know, art projects on Pinterest and kind of then make these art projects. And we later with you, you know, ended up adding another child to that class. So, yeah, so our daughter was doing a lot online. But, yeah, Jeremy and I make probably less of a distinction with most people of like, oh, I feel like when most people hear screen time, they picture like, okay, you're just like setting your child by themselves to like passively watch the movie, you know, in this very passive, isolated environment. And that is something we really try to avoid and very, very rarely do. That we've only, I mean, that's not something that's routinely part of our lives. And we have used it like in emergency situations. But, you know, to me, that's, you know, just drastically different than like, oh, my daughter's like dancing with her best friend and it just happens to be with a computer screen, you know, like through a computer screen. Yeah, so that was our view. We had been actually even a year prior to this, we had been using some apps for learning. I know that Jeremy started with, I'm not going to have the exact order, but Teacher Monster to Read and Learn with Homer, of working on reading skills with our daughter. And again, though, that was something that they did relationally. Like he, for a while, actually, he would always take her out to breakfast in the morning and they would sit and be doing the app together. But it's something they're chatting about. And again, it's kind of this very, very relational thing of learning. And so, yes, I do think it helped us that we were both kind of open to the idea of like relationships that are facilitated through technology are still, they're still real. They're still relationships. That even using apps can be relational when you're discussing it with your child. Or later we ended up having tutors working with our daughter. But again, it's, you know, this is a trusted adult and it's a relationship and not just kind of the child doing something on their own in isolation.
Yeah, you have a really wonderful framework around screen time for parents, and we'll post a link to your blog. But if I understand correctly, you kind of talk about the highest form of screen time as engaged educational time. So a child might be
engaged, educational, yes, and relational.
And yeah, relationship.
So three aspects. Yeah.
So an example might be your child is doing an adaptive learning app with a tutor and talking through the app, or with a parent working with them.
Yes.
Or with a parent working with them.
And also like a kind of one of these I think about is also the difference between creation and consumption as well, of like, you know, consuming media, you know, watching a TV show is what people think of, but also creation. Like my daughter loves, I would say coding and art are probably her two favorite subjects. And she is making really, really creative and fun programs in Scratch and in P5.js. And, you know, it's like when she's building and creating something, like I kind of put creative work also is different than just kind of consuming something that somebody else has created.
I love that distinction. And I feel like, you know, my views have evolved so much through talking to you. I mean, coming from a perspective where I just felt like kids should just be outside playing all day long and that's it. And then kind of seeing how really what you do in fast.ai and artificial intelligence is you're really creating art. And, you know, having technology is another way that supports our learning and allows children to relate in a different way and to be creative. And you're also so mindful about the tools you choose, which I think is a really important point for parents. Like in Reggio Emilia approach, we talk about the environment as the child's third teacher.
Yeah.
And I mean, from the beginning, you've been so selective about the type of mic, the type of camera, the type of, you know, rug and pillows that she's sitting on. And that's an important part of it, too.
It is. Yeah. We think a lot about ergonomics. And then also, like, I like that my daughter can really be comfortable. Like we, you know, like if she wants to do a class, like in bed, surrounded with her stuffed animals, like that's fine. Like we want her to you know, be in an environment where she's comfortable. And she currently, I don't know if you've seen her blanket fort.
I have
fort
that taught her from my bed surrounded by stuffed animals, so I can relate.
But yeah, so now she's got a blanket fort going in her room. And we'll do some of her classes from inside of there. But that she's getting to be comfortable and to have some level of control over her environment too, of kind of how she wants to arrange things. And yeah, we've tried all sorts of, you know, like flexible screen holder devices. So if she wants to be able to lie on the floor, or really kind of customize how she uses her technology.
Wonderful. So why do you think, I mean, I guess it's somewhat less so after the pandemic, but why do you think parents have a lot of fear around technology? Is there misinformation out there, or what do you think is driving this concern?
Some of it is, I think, just overly grouping together. So as I mentioned before, I do think a lot of parents just, you know, think of, like your kids watching a movie by themselves and that's it. And that kind of, they associate all, I don't even like the phrase screen time, because I just feel like it's too
so generic. You
know, it's so overly broad as to be meaningless to me. But I think that a lot of parents, anything related to screen time, they just think, oh, your child's passively watching TV by themselves. And some of that I think has evolved from I think many parents, if they're flying on an airplane, like that's what they're going to do. It's a stressful situation, you know, that's fine. But I think because they were used to kind of only using technology as like a last resort, maybe hadn't seen some of the kind of the more positive aspects. And then I think also there's now another, a bit of a blurring going along too with, and I think this is more relevant to older children, but just concerns about social media. And again, kind of just blurring that into screen time. And so they hear screen time and they think, oh, is this just a kid like reading Instagram or something? As well as, third aspect I just thought of is apps have improved so much in recent years. Like I was really like some of the stuff like drag and box algebra and slice fractions, I'll talk about a lot. They are beautiful and they are engaging and they are so thoughtfully designed. These are two different math apps. One's focused on algebra. And I'm like, drag and box algebra, like this is a superior way to introduce kids to algebra than anything I had seen previously. But I wasn't aware that stuff like that existed. And so I also think some people have, you know, just have experience with kind of, you know, basically, you know, maybe like putting a multiple choice exam on a computer.
I like, what is it, Fortnite? Or am I saying this wrong? The video game Fortnite, everyone's playing? I was not allowed to play video games as a child, so I'm a little out of that world. But yeah, I think that people do think about that and a child's eyes kind of glazing over. And there's a lot of guilt, like, oh, I'm using this for childcare kind of thing. But I think that you do make a good point that there are some that really allow for more creativity as opposed to, I don't know, cheap dopamine addiction. Like they're
And that's like a real concern about cheap dopamine addiction. But again, that really varies, I feel like, based on the app or game you're using and how you're using it. And so it does. And it also takes time to sort through all this and see what the different games are and to figure out. And it is also, it's like an ongoing conversation and discussion. But yeah, I do think that, these discussions about screen time are often kind of just overly broad and often, I feel like, overly focused on like the worst incarnations of screen time.
Sure. And actually, Jeremy and I made a list of our 50 favorite apps. So I'll drop that in the notes well. So it's like can take a while to sort through everything. Oh.
The one other thing that I do try to think about a lot, too, is, you know, sometimes you kind of mentioned the argument of, you know, people thinking like, oh, the child should be outside instead of on the screen or something. And I agree, children should get time outside. My daughter, you know, gets time outside. That's important to me. But I try to think of it as more kind of positively of like, OK, how much is the time I want my daughter outside? How much time do we want her playing sports? I love that, like for her to have time where she's just reading a book. I think that's super valuable to get lost in a book. but more think about like, is my daughter kind of getting these other things I want? And, you know, am I scheduling those in, as opposed to, I think it can be overly reductive to see it as this like exclusive, like, okay, either your child's outside or they're on a screen. Whereas it's like, well, I feel like we've worked both into our schedule regularly.
Do you ever feel like you have to pull her away from the screen, or?
I should also give this background. Like, Edith, as a kid, I love to read. And, you know, if someone gave me the choice, like, Rachel, do you want to go play outside or read? Like, I would say, I want to read. And Jeremy was a similar way about computers. It was like, no, I'd rather be coding than go outside. And so, you know, my daughter does have some of those tendencies. If we're like, oh, let's go for a walk now. And, you know, she can do it. She'll be like, but I have a bug in my program. Like, I need to keep debugging. Or if she's so into Warrior Cats right now. If she's in the middle of a book, you know, it's just like, she's like, oh, but it's in an exciting part. And these books are just like nonstop cliffhangers. Right. Like, it's all exciting series. Parts.
Yes.
Yeah. And so recognizing, and you know, it helps that we have her, you know, she plays tennis twice a week. She does trampoline lessons weekly. Like, she does have weekly, you know, regular activities. And then we're also getting her outside for walks and for play dates. And then in the summer, swimming. I guess also kind of wanting to like honor her inclinations as well, though, of like, it's also okay to like indoor activities, as long as you're, yeah, kind of getting some of both.
That's so great. I mean, I think even when you were talking about it, she doesn't want to leave because she's engaged in doing something. She's discovering an important part of the book. She's creating, she's debugging her app. It's not that she just is kind of, just can't even function or be pulled away from this intoxicating dinging sound.
yes.
wonderful. So could you just give us more of a flavor of what this looks like in practice? Some people might be wondering about your homeschooling. I mean, keeping in mind that the beauty of homeschooling is that you can curate it for your own individual child.
Yes.
But maybe take us through a day in her life or a week in her life.
Yeah. And so this, so we started when she was 4.5, she's 8 now. So this has changed, but she does a mix of online classes and now from a few different sites and also a few different sizes, you know, this model of her best friend also homeschools. And so, you know, there are a number of classes that we do with you, Manisha, you know, where it's her friend and a tutor. And that's I think it's such a great dynamic to kind of have, you know, have another child or two there, but also to be kind of getting a lot of, you know, to really be able to engage. Going along with that, I just say my daughter is very, very talkative, and kind of a misconception, or not misconception. I know every child is different, but I've sometimes heard parents say like, oh, you know, homeschooling wouldn't work for my child because they're too social. Whereas I actually feel like my daughter to talk more with the approach we're using than she did in the class of 20 students, that she kind of has so many kind of like smaller group interactions where she is kind of getting to talk more and be, more conversational and more engaged.
I considered her to be one of my best friends. So there you go. But it's true. It's true. It's hard for, I mean, I was one of those talkers. I just wanted to raise my hand all the time and I had to be budgeted in class for how much I was allowed to talk.
Yeah. And that's also something where I think online classes and online tutors have been so helpful in that, like, I mean, I love talking with my daughter. She's so creative and funny at this point. She's really creative, but it is like as a parent, it is helpful to have other adults in her life that she can talk to and other kids. Like, I mean, she's also at a point where, she has some friends that she does virtual play dates with, and they can talk for hours, you know, and they'll be like, you know, switching between like building Legos and talking, and then maybe they'll play an interactive game, you know, but it's very, can be very conversational. But sorry, back to your question about a kind of average day. So we really varies. She might have, we're kind of at slightly more now, a few hours of class. So maybe she has 2 or 3 hours of class in the morning. And what those classes are varies from day to day. And then, yeah, some free time, and we might go for a walk or read, or she can play. She loves origami. She wants to find time to do origami kind of every day. Another hour or two of classes in the afternoon, and then often an extracurricular kind of in person at 3 p.m. And then some days we do play dates with other families in our area. But I like that. Yeah, I like that we have flexibility. We're kind of frequently kind of recalibrating both what online classes she takes and, we can be very responsive to her interest, which I like. And so I mentioned, you know, she likes art and coding. And so I feel like we both basically are kind of treating those as core subjects now. And of course, you know, math and English, we'll always have as core as well. She likes astronomy. She's doing a biochemistry literacy for kids. A lot of these classes, though, are just like the biochemistry or astronomy, you know, that's just once a week. And so you can kind of fit a lot of stuff in that way.
Wonderful. It's so great. There's just so much diversity to her classes, and it's wonderful that she can change and start something new as she gets, you know, some subjects she's been studying for years and others it might just be for a few months. And that's really great.
Yeah. And I'll say one other thing that kind of came up earlier, but something I like about homeschooling is that it does give us like blocks of time to be flexible about. And, you know, in hindsight, so much of school, they're asking kids to switch their attention kind of constantly. You know, it's like, do this activity for 20 minutes. Okay, and now you have to stop and do this other thing for 30 minutes, and not giving kids the option. And I realize it wouldn't be feasible with a whole class of students, but to like, if you're really absorbed in something, you might want to spend 2 or 3 hours doing that. And that's, you know, that's something like adults really seek out, you know, the idea of flow, or to be able to kind of really concentrate and get in the flow on something. And I do like that with my daughter's schedule, we have enough flexibility. Like, we do have, you know, some online classes scheduled, but we also have these blocks of time where if she really gets into something, we're like, just keep going with it. You know, that's great.
Completely. And just underlying, I think a lot of what you said is that she has been able to move forward at her own pace. And, you know, and we found that accident of that when she moved forward with a tutor in math and an app during the pandemic, she moved forward through the entire K through 8th grade curriculum in 6 months.
Yeah, wow. Yeah,
yeah. Oops. And then, you know, when she went to more of a traditional, but, you know, very advanced school, she got bored very quickly, not being able to move forward at her own pace, and just allowing that freedom. You know, I remember when she started really knowing how to read very well. One time I came on and, you know, you said, well, she's really enjoying this novel, so she's just going to read her novel today. And that was great. And I went off and did my thing. Or, you know, another day, oh, you know, she really needs to get outside, so we're not going to do class today. And just having that flexibility to respond to her energy levels and her engagement is just so great. I mean, it seems normal. You know, why shouldn't everyone be able to learn that way?
Yeah, no, yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. And that's something we still do. It's like, you know, we have stuff scheduled that we mostly stick to, but then we also, yeah, like if she's really into something or needs something else, we are flexible about like, oh, you know, we will cancel this so she can, yeah, kind of keep going with what she's doing. I guess, I don't know. I know I kind of glossed over this maybe in my story, but yeah, she, yeah. So when she was doing Modulo during that first year of the pandemic, yeah, she was working on a math app an hour a day. And Jeremy and I really didn't have any expectations for where she would end up with that. It was just kind of like, okay, this is, you know, something she's doing. And this was, you know, in a small group, just with, I can't remember if it was the three other kids and a tutor.
Varied, yeah.
And
yeah.
They could, you know, and they could ask the tutor if they needed help. And it was, yeah, it was just 1 hour a day. And we really had no goals for where she was supposed to get with that. And yeah, then when we took her to a school here, she was 5 and a half at the time, and they were like, you know, she's on a fifth grade level for math, but that was the pace she was going at.
Yeah, no rushing at all. I mean, and I do think one of the things that really helped is that we used a mastery-based learning app that was adaptive, and so it just kept moving forward at the right level, and the kids could play and they would always be advancing. So there was that arc that was provided by the tool, the learning tool, which is Prodigy Game.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, and I really appreciate your focus on mastery-based learning. And I do think that, to me, now seems like kind of one of the really key limitations of traditional school, of just, you know, I know they try to kind of break the kids out somewhat to meet where they are, but it's just, you can't when you have 20 kids that are all going to have to get to the same place at the end of the semester. It just kind of doesn't allow the flexibility for really meeting the kid where they are and at the pace that they that child needs to go at.
Right. I mean, there's the question of curriculum. I mean, are they taking one concept and building upon it to the next? But then there's also that question of pace, and it's impossible in a group setting. You're always going to be too fast or too slow because everybody learns at a different pace. Yeah. You can't just evolve organically. So, yeah, so that's tricky. All right. So many questions. So I guess kind of coming back to this, I mean, you have integrated these great classes, and I'm wondering if, you know, when you had a child and you started thinking about, you know, what are your goals for your child's education? I mean, Rachel, you're really at the forefront, you know, working in AI, you kind of have a better glimpse of the future than I do, you know? And so what are kind of some of the skills you might've thought of that could be important for your child as she grows up and lives in a rapidly changing world?
I really think most still about kind of things that are, I see as fundamental, even apart from AI. And one of that, a really core thing I feel like is just staying connected to your intrinsic curiosity and your intrinsic motivation. And that kind of, yeah, I don't know what skills are going to be useful 10 or 20 years from now. But I feel like if kids, and really if adults, you know, can get in touch or stay in touch with kind of their intrinsic curiosity and intrinsic motivation, that's what's going to let you kind of keep learning new skills and keep kind of finding your interest, even if those are kind of new things that are evolving.
And when you say that, I mean, you live it. You offer this course in AI to many beginning adults who've never coded before, and they're able to teach themselves.
Yeah, so that was kind of, our vision with Fast AI was really wanting people from all different backgrounds. And I really do believe kind of any field is made stronger through diversity. And that includes, kind of the diversity of background. I also really believe you're kind of never too old to learn something. I guess maybe in some ways you're also never too young. Like there's, you know, there's such a range and that they're... It really upsets me to see kind of unnecessary gatekeeping of like, oh, only, you know, and this is something that, you know, I was hearing a ton of in tech 10 years ago of like, oh, you know, you have to have done your PhD with like these four advisors or else you can't do deep learning, you know, like you can't access the secret knowledge. And it was such a kind of insider's club. And I think that is so harmful to fields to have that sort of attitude. And so I do, really value kind of being able to see people from different backgrounds and also recognizing that that's a strength, that kind of being really familiar with a different background like that gives you important knowledge. I mean, in context, deep learning refers to, you know, multi-layered neural networks, this family of algorithms that's responsible for kind of most advances in AI that we're seeing right now.
Oh, now I understand.
it's a family of algorithms.
Okay, a family of algorithms and the networks, the neural networks. Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, the style of algorithm or programming, it's using a lot of data, often requiring GPUs. So the same, you know, processing units that are used for video games. To find patterns kind of through a lot of data.
Interesting. So what would be some of the applications of this research of deep learning?
Deep learning is what, I mean, most recently with things like ChatGPT, like that's, you know, within that umbrella of kind of these large language models, but also going back to, you know, Google Photos, automatically classifying your photos, you know, so you can search for, you know, show me my food pictures or something and it'll pull it up. Translation programs, you know, so Skype Translator, Google Translate, those are using deep learning. It's used in medical imaging to, you know, automatically identify tumors or kind of abnormalities in an MRI.
Yeah, it actually kind of leads me to another question I was going to ask you is, I mean, what kind of impact do you think that AI could have on education and how we educate our children? I mean, clearly a lot of students are using ChatGPT. There's companies that are coming out with these AI tutors. Have you thought about how it might transform the education system for children in particular?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, so we are, you know, we've talked earlier about how there are apps that are much better than there was anything 10 years ago. I think adaptive learning is great. I will say, though, I still think human relationships are incredibly important and will remain very important. And that it's definitely helpful to have kind of better apps, but I don't really picture a scenario where that like eliminates the value of kind of having a human tutor to discuss with, or kind of having, you know, both not just from the knowledge perspective, but also the relationship side. And this is something I know you had kind of asked about in a previous discussion, that to me, kind of one of the most time consuming aspects of homeschooling is the relationship side. And that is something that I don't think can be automated. So I would say, like, something that I spend a surprising amount of time on is contacting other parents and setting up play dates for my daughter, you know, and that building relationships is time consuming. But that's not something that, yeah, that I think can be automated.
Yeah, I thought I was going to ask you about that because, you know, I've somehow kind of built my company around your family. And you mentioned to me that it's
good.
Honored.
It's good.
I mean, I'm honored. It's been such a great case study. But, you know, when you told me that homeschooling had become a part-time job for you, part of me felt like I was failing you, you know, because I wanted to know, because we have some entrepreneurs listening to the show. And so that's what I was wondering. I mean, are there tools and technologies that could be built that would maybe save you time? Or is this just something that you are glad to be doing, that you're glad to be setting aside this time to do this part-time homeschooling job?
It's, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to do. I don't know, like, I think about something like, you know, online dating, you know, like, I mean, people have been making dating apps for like 20 years, but my understanding is that dating is still really time consuming.
They're not working for me, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've,
yeah, no, this is what I hear from friends, that it's not like it's not like a magic shortcut that of like, okay, you know, this is going to pair you. And I do think they're kind of parallels with trying to beat other families. And, you know, we've met a lot of families, but it does take time. It does take trial and error. But it's not something I think can be automated. And I will say that's, I think, one of the things I try to be careful about not romanticizing school. Like when I was in school, and I went to this, you know, traditional public school through 12th grade. But I would typically have one or two best friends, but they weren't always in my class, you know? And so, like, I mean, there are, you know, I can think of entire years, like maybe third grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, where, you know, my best friend wasn't in my class at school. So I'm still mostly just seeing them like nights and weekends, you know, it's not, anyway, so I realized that being in a class doesn't guarantee, you know, that you have a best friend in that class. But I do think it is more work on the relationship side, homeschooling, of just, it's very intentional effort to try to connect with people.
It's a funny thing about freedom, Rachel. I mean, lately I've been traveling a lot and I have this freedom to choose whatever country I want to live in and be friends with whoever I want. And it does take a lot of time to make all those choices. And I think homeschooling is similar. It's not like you're limited to this certain group of people who you may or may not like. You have this freedom to choose who you want to spend your time with. And that can be time consuming in and of itself.
Yes. Yes. No, totally. I agree with that. And I think, you know, it was really helpful, like through Modulo and the, you know, the Kids Club you created, that, I mean, that was a small group, but that actually made things easier for us, you know, and that, you know, also like the families involved had some common traits that we were working with you and had kind of similar visions. But, you know, our kids did really connect, even though that was from a very, very small group.
Yes, it was the founders of Fast.ai, two machine learnists at Google, and two international best-selling authors in tech in three different cities. The kids, it took the kids a while. I'm going to say that at the beginning, they were kind of just relating with me and not with each other. And then they got going. But it's great to be able to connect with people who share your interests and values in that way, if you can. So that's also another benefit of technology.
Yes, it is. And our daughter now, like, I mean, she'll sometimes, I mean, it's, you know, it's fun as she gets older, like she'll sometimes come to us of like, oh, I made this, you know, friend in this online class I'm in, you know, we, you know, connect with the teacher to get the other parents' info. But then she has made friends in, yeah, in other states and other countries that way. And it, you know, it is kind of neat that you can connect, but you're right. Like there can also be an overwhelming amount of choice. And like actually some of the larger like homeschooling Facebook groups, it just feels like too much, you know, of even, okay, even if they're good resources in here, it's just an overwhelming amount of choice and an overwhelming amount of people.
Definitely. You need a matchmaker like Manisha.
Yes. Yes. No, exactly. No,
it's my job.
You do.
4-year-old dates, 8-year-old dates. Oh, wonderful. So, okay. I do want to talk a little bit about math because you have so many wonderful insights in this topic, on this topic. So you and I, well, you did a workshop that I hosted called What was it called?
There's no such thing as not a math person. Yeah,
thank you. There's no such thing as not a math person. And I often hear from families, I could never homeschool because I'm bad at math. And I don't think that's true. Obviously, you don't think that's true. Why do people seem to have such low confidence when it comes to math?
Math has often not been taught very well. And it's taught in a very vertical manner. So it's like, you know, what you learned this year, you know, you're going to need it for the next year, and then you're going to need that for the next year. And so if you have a bad year, it can just totally kind of screw you over for all the coming years. And that can be whether you have a bad teacher or even if something's going wrong in your personal life, that it can be really hard to bounce back from. So I think a lot of people have had kind of understandably bad math experiences in school, and then not been able to come back from that. There are also studies in the U.S. that many primary school teachers do have math anxiety, and they do end up transmitting that to their students. So I think there are a number of reasons that people, and sometimes math can be taught in a very dry way that is kind of off-putting. So a lot of adults do kind of have, and I've seen this of, you know, when I would tell people I have a math PhD, I've gotten a lot of reactions around like, oh, math, or, you know, my brain doesn't work that way. So I think that's a challenge. I think a key thing to keep in mind is that you don't have to have all the answers to teach your child, and that it's, you know, it's, and then this, I mean, this is true of teaching in general, that it's fine to model not knowing something and the process you go about how you look something up and how you, you know, when you don't know something, like what is the process you follow to try to learn it or look it up? And I think it's super valuable for kids and for students of all ages to see that. But I think that when we approach teaching, there could often be this mindset of like, it's almost scary to be asked a question you don't know the answer to right away. And you know, I think this is kind of maybe a misunderstanding of teaching, the idea that like, oh, a teacher should instantly know all the answers, as opposed to this is someone who models like how you learn or find answers. So that's one aspect, although I also do totally support. And I mean, this is something we'll do, like if there's a subject that my daughter's really interested in, like, I mean, definitely, you know, hiring a tutor in that area, if it's not something that I feel competent in, is valuable. But I've already like worked through some classes with my daughter. Like I was actually taking a genetics class this summer for myself. It was geared towards adults, and she was having a blast watching the videos with me, and would work on the questions together. And you know, and I think there is something really valuable of like, you know, her getting to see like, okay, I'm learning these genetics concepts too. That it can, I think, be very valuable to kind of learn alongside your child, because, you know, one of the things I would hope for my daughter is that she'll always be learning, you know, and that And you know, that relates maybe a bit to your question about kind of how the future's changing of, you know, I can't exactly predict that, but I hope that my daughter, yeah, will emerge as somebody who's always able to learn and can enjoy learning.
It's so great. And I hope this isn't too personal, but I know that at one point perfectionism was an issue with your daughter. And we had a conversation about it and said, well, is there anyone else in the family who might be a perfectionist? And you just leapt on it. And you were so eager to, you know, look at yourself and think about what behavior might be. You might be modeling to your daughter and start showing her how you could embrace failure and mistakes. And it immediately caused a shift in her own relationship to failure. And I just thought that was so great. I mean, just A+ parenting there.
Oh, thank you. No, that's still a work in progress. Actually, this genetics class I mentioned, yeah, there are a few times where like,
you haven't got it perfect yet.
Yeah, like I'm doing a quiz together and get something wrong, and I'd be like, oh man, and Claire, man. And my daughter would be like, oh, it's fine, you know, it's okay. It's okay, we got something wrong, Mom.
We failed, woohoo! Party time! We learned something.
Yeah, although, I mean, you do, yeah. So perfectionism has been an issue for both of us. But really, I mean, the thing that made perfectionism kind of worse for our daughter was being in school. And so that was something that was, it is very obvious in hindsight. It was kind of harder to recognize as we were going through it. But I think that she, you know, in school, you know, was just getting a lot of like, oh, you're so smart. You're such a good girl. And was getting this kind of really positive feedback. And she wasn't really having to push herself at all because she was kind of ahead and knew the material. And so she kind of, you know, further fed into, she felt like she could get things right without trying. And so then activities like, so she's been playing the piano and doing chess since she was 5. And those are both activities where you have to make mistakes. If you can't practice piano without making mistakes, chess, again, you kind of have to make mistakes as you're playing. And she really got to where she didn't want to do them anymore. And she even, you know, with, you know, piano can articulate, like, I don't want to practice because I'm going to make a mistake. And that was, yeah, that was, it was hard to see. And really the thing that helped most was when we took her back out of school. And her school, though, like the principal and vice principal are like super into Carol Dweck and growth mindset. And I mean, they had like flown internationally to meet with Carol Dweck. So, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't even that like that it wasn't on the radar screen for the school. But I think with that setup where she was ahead and she wasn't having to really think, she wasn't having to take risks. It was just really hard for her to develop or maintain a growth mindset or a mindset around mistakes being positive.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, even if a teacher has that mentality of praising hard work, I mean, there is, if they ask the class a question and one child knows, and then everyone is impressed by that child knowing, the child starts to identify with being right as who they are and how they get praise and how they make friends.
Yes,
and then
yeah.
Being wrong, it's, well, who am I if I'm wrong? And how can I be loved if I'm wrong? And
yes,
so that can get tricky. For sure.
No, totally. Through most of my life or most of my schooling, you know, I was the top student and I was really used to that. And I, you know, in adulthood, you know, came to see like, oh, that was actually kind of a disadvantage because I didn't learn to take enough risk. And I was also just too focused on doing what others had asked of me and didn't have enough. Yeah, I feel like as an adult, I had to develop more like intrinsic, like, how do I pick what the interesting questions are and not just, you know, answering what an adult has told me is the question that's important to answer.
Completely. I mean, I remember just getting an A- in a class in college and being just devastated, sobbing in my teacher's office. It just hit me at my core. And it was really only when I started my second startup that it occurred to me that if I hit a problem area, and as I was able to push past that, I would be that much further ahead than all of the competitors because I had pushed past that area where we weren't getting it right and we were failing. And, you know, for example, when we were first trying to hire teachers for Modula, I think we've gotten quite good at this. I was trying to hire trained teachers and it wasn't really working. And then I tried doing like actors and actresses because they were really good performers. And that wasn't quite working. And then we started hiring child life specialists who are trained to work with children in hospitals. And they did a really good job because they were able to understand the developmental stages of the children and how to communicate and, you know, all of that training and growth mindset and grit and trauma and how to, you know, just nurture a child, that intrinsic motivation. And so then I started giving the actors and actresses lessons on communicating with children and pairing them with adaptive learning apps. And that's when everything started to work really well. So it's, you know, it was, but it was, took a month of being deciding I'm going to just focus on this one problem and get it right.
No, that also, that, I mean, that shows great open-mindedness on your part to kind of pursue so many different, different backgrounds.
I guess so. But I think it really was a shift in, you know, in me as a person and in deciding not to be a perfectionist anymore and really embrace the grit. So maybe that might be kind of a cheesy transition time to immunology about grit and dirt and how immune systems are built. But I know that you're studying immunology. And I mean, this pandemic has been really intense for all of us. And there is a myth that I'm just dying for you to bust, which is that if a child is exposed to lots of illnesses in a big school, that somehow makes their immune system stronger. There's so many people who have this idea, and I would like you to articulate your thoughts on such a concept. Does being exposed to sickness make our immune system stronger?
So I think this is a overgeneralization or even kind of a perversion from two areas of research. So there is evidence that getting parasitic worms is good for basically like the part of the immune system that ends up causing allergies. So there are some benefits to getting parasitic worms.
All right, I'll go get some of those at the store.
Which, yeah, I know it's funny because, you know, like I think a lot of people see that as like grosser than catching a virus, but actually there is way more evidence around parasitic worms than viruses. And then also let me know that healthy bacteria in our microbiome is a positive. But I think that generalizing from worms and from healthy bacteria to viruses is quite a leap, or even generalizing to pathogens in general. And so, yeah, I have not seen evidence that catching a bunch of viruses is good for us. And we're also kind of on the copper side. We're seeing a lot of, I mean, I think we're at a fascinating time in immunology and virology, but in terms of beginning to understand some more about the long-term consequences of viruses, you know, so last year there was the paper that basically proved that Epstein-Barr virus causes multiple sclerosis, you know, and this kind of very direct link. I mean, this common virus causing quite a serious illness. There's also been increasing research on the role that viruses play in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. And so some very kind of large studies on, yeah, kind of how linked viruses are to those. We're learning new links between viruses and cancer all the time. Viruses, you know, can also trigger autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes. So there's a lot of potential harms of kind of like long-term damages from these viruses. And then there's also with immunity, I know there's questions about how long immunity to any virus even lasts. I believe it's NL63, which is one of the kind of common cold coronaviruses, but that people can catch the, like, it's not even mutating, but people can catch the same variant multiple times. But then, you know, I mean, there are over 200 viruses that cause, quote, common colds also. And so catching one's not going to necessarily help you with the others. And so it has been concerning to see kind of this overplush of people assuming that, you know, all illness is good or all illness makes you stronger, when we know that there can be very kind of well documented harms from many illnesses.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I was working as a private tutor in New York City, I was very careful about washing my hands, drinking a lot of green juice, salad, all that stuff. And I almost never got sick. But when I was subbing in the public schools and the private schools, often, you know, and it would often be for a couple months at a time at a school. I mean, I was just sick all the time. And I know, you know, my friends who send their kids to school or daycare, they're just sick. I mean, the parents get more sick than the kids. I mean, is there something about that environment of a daycare or a school that makes you get sick more often?
Yeah, I mean, totally. So I think, you know, and this is a topic I didn't know much about a few years ago, but recognizing just the crucial role that air quality plays in all of this. And, you know, I now believe clean air is a human right. And it's something, it's, you know, it really angers me. Like, if you're a member of parliament, like, they have really upgraded their ventilation systems and their air purifiers. But most school children don't have it. There are a few, like, there's some kind of ultra wealthy school districts that politicians send their kids to that have, you know, like, spent $40 million improving air quality. But most children do not have access to this. And I think, I mean, I think that clean air quality is, I hope it's something that we make major, major structural changes to ensure for people in the future. But just to talk about, yeah, kind of a few aspects of it. So one, you know, as we're talking about, like, I think far more viruses are airborne than was previously realized. And so people are catching pathogens through the air. And a lot of schools are really poorly ventilated. And you have kind of a lot of kids in a very small space. There's also then, even apart from illness, mold can be carried in the air. Allergens. And so having any sort of air purification is going to help with all of this in terms of kind of reducing illnesses, reducing mold, reducing allergens. There's also the issue of the air purifiers are kind of one aspect, but also ventilation, which is kind of how much new air you're bringing in. And that's important for keeping CO2 levels down. I don't know if you're familiar with this, the high CO2 levels are not great for our brains. And so there have even been studies on, like, chess players. And if the CO2 level is too high, they make more mistakes. And so this really impacts kind of cognitive function and impacts alertness. And so, again, it's important to kind of be bringing in new air, to have windows open. And fortunately, many, many schools have kind of done the opposite. I know, like, many schools in the U.S., like, don't want to have windows open because they have safety concerns. I mean, there are even schools where, like, the windows are, like, painted shut. And then there's also, with the push for energy efficiency over the past few decades, that's often looked like, though, just recirculating air. And so not bringing new air in, not cleaning it. So I think that's one huge factor that kind of impacts how often children are getting sick and how often they're exposed to illness at school.
That's really intriguing. I mean, I always thought it was just the density of people and the fact that the kids were touching the tables with all their germy hands and wiping their nose.
I'm not sure the density plays a role as well. Yeah, no,
the air is also not something that I realized. And I think also, you know, kids don't get a lot of time to play outside. And it seems like something that a school could implement. I mean, if someone is here and they're on the PTA or wants to talk to their PTA and get air purification, that's very actionable. So, Rachel, as we start to wrap up, I do want to address something. We've talked a little bit around it, but I thought it would be good to just address it headlong. So you wrote this amazing blog, My Family's Unlikely Journey to Homeschooling, and someone posted it on Hacker News. And like many of your blogs, it went straight to the first page. And someone commented, I guess the top comment was someone saying, okay, well, that's great for the cognitive elite, for two really smart parents, but how can a normal parent homeschool? It's only for people who are really smart. So I was curious how you might address that. Is homeschooling only for the cognitive elite? Do you have to be very well educated to be able to homeschool your child?
No. Yeah. I mean, I think many, many children could benefit from homeschooling. I think I just want to acknowledge, like, I think all children have passions and interest, and, you know, and in many cases, it's not even possible for schools to kind of fully meet those or encourage those. And that homeschooling does give you this option to kind of really encourage your child's kind of particular interest and customize towards them. And that with kind of with the number of, and I do want to acknowledge like being able to afford more online classes or more online tutors definitely opens up more options. Although for, I mean, still for deeper than what you would pay for a private school, that there are also so many ways to supplement kind of, they're just amazing online classes. And I mean, even amazing online YouTube channels, you know, teaching very scientific material, like in really, really engaging ways, that there's so many resources. And actually, I guess this is probably one of those misconceptions I had, you know, 4 years ago about homeschooling, is that I thought the parent was having to generate most of it, you know, thinking like, oh, if you homeschool, like as a parent, you're having to, you would have to be teaching everything or designing all these curricula. But there are so many helpful resources out there now. And also just such a diverse array of homeschoolers. You kind of get into these, various like Facebook groups for homeschooling. I mean, just wide variety of people. And you can find some really helpful advice and, yeah, different resources. So no, I don't think it's just for the cognitively elite. And I think that the benefits of kind of the getting to do more one-on-one, more small group stuff, would really be valuable for a lot of children.
For sure. And one thing I really enjoyed during the pandemic was learning how to draw, because we watched this Art for Kids Hub channel together.
I'm
not an expert in drawing, but I got quite good at it just doing it with the children. And you gave an example of learning genetics with your daughter. I think that perhaps we didn't learn all the things we wanted to learn in school. Maybe we might be concerned that we don't know how to do second grade math. So homeschooling offers an opportunity to go back and learn with your child. And now there are just so many resources to support you.
Yes. Yeah. Another example of this is chess. So I hated chess when I was a kid. I just thought it was so boring. The games take so long. And so I learned like the basic rules. Although my daughter will point out, I didn't even know that castling.
Oh my gosh. Thing, you didn't even know that.
Didn't even know about castling. Yeah. No, so it's kind of funny. Like people assume that Jeremy and I must be into chess since our daughter is a chess player, but it's really just, we're just looking for stuff to keep.
Might be just because you're nerdy.
it's now been rebranded. It's called Dragon Box Chess. Like this game is like such a fun way to learn chess, you know, and it's something, it's like, okay, if this had existed like 30 years ago, I would have liked chess, you know. It's like a really fun way to learn it. And this is something that totally my husband and I have just learned alongside our daughter that we started watching the Chess Kid videos together. And I think that's so valuable for kids to see. Plus it's something like, my daughter's better than me. She spends more time on it than I do. But, you know, she's gotten to see her parents kind of learn a lot of this alongside her, which, yeah, I think is really valuable to see, because it's really, I mean, I think that's one of the key things I want for her, is just to always feel like she can pick up new things. And yeah, if there's something that she doesn't know and her parents don't know, that, you know, we'll seek out the resources and that she can learn it.
So wonderful. A while back, one of our families wanted me to do private lessons with their son in person. And basically all we did is he wanted to do was teach me chess. And that's what we did every lesson. And I do think that teaching is the final stage of mastery, and it can be great for a child to teach their parent a skill. It helps identify things that you don't know and makes you feel confident.
Yeah, I do think teaching is how you kind of cement your knowledge. Yeah, like my daughter, she likes to give me origami lessons. And I think it's really valuable, also for kids to get that experience of teaching a skill they have.
And kids can figure out a lot more than we give them credit. And if we give them that space and time to get their wheels turning when they ask a question and try to think, okay, what can I pull in here to figure this out? That it really helps their learning skills. I mean, I did a lot of high-end tutoring. So I was really focusing on like, how do we get from missing one question on the SAT to missing no questions or just, you know, kinds of, you know, lasering in. And so I've taught a lot. I mean, 2,000 kids, 3 countries, like many, many subjects. And but really now all I do is I just go show up and say, I don't know. You tell me. I mean, that's my teaching style now. And it works really well. I just don't teach. I just, you know, support their learning. That's it.
Yeah. No, and I wrote about this in the blog post. Like, one of my kind of most valuable teaching experiences was when I was working at a coding academy for adult women, where they would, they spend 5 weeks doing a very in-depth project on their own. And for the project, they were often choosing software libraries that I hadn't necessarily used before. And, you know, I initially had this like, oh my gosh, they're asking me questions about like a software library I've never used. But then to realize like, oh, you know, really I'm just teaching the project, the skills of debugging of like, okay, if I have no idea what the answer is, these are the questions I would ask, and these are the places I would search for answers. And that's kind of the most, I think, one of the most valuable skills.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. It's so incredible all the ways that you've empowered your child's learning. And you know, as we've been developing these tools together, I just want to say that, you know, when we discovered that tutoring helped facilitate learning, I built a nonprofit that does free tutoring for kids. And so many of the resources are free, and a lot of the curriculum providers have grants to give resources for free to families. And so childcare is a real problem, whether or not you go to school. It's a problem if you're in school or not in school. So I don't want to undervalue that. And there are techniques to help. It's not the subject of this episode, but in terms of the education, whether you need a tutor or a math app or whatever, there's a way to get it for free for sure. So.
Yeah. And I will also say I have found a lot of free groups in terms of kids getting together on a shared interest of, you know, whether that's a chess club or a scratch club, a programming club of, yeah, kind of kids being able to gather and share kind of what they're doing and learning. There are, yeah, there are definitely free options out there.
That's wonderful. I usually end each episode asking the guest what they're learning now that they're excited about. And you've already talked so much about what you're learning. And I think it's one of the reasons I feel such an affinity to you, because you are such a lifelong learner. And anyway, this has been so interesting, and I just treasure you and your family so much, and really appreciate you taking the time to share your story with all of us today.
Oh yeah, no, thank you. We appreciate so much everything that you've done for our daughter, and just kind of really being able to kind of co-develop this new to me, at least, way of thinking about education and thinking about what's possible.
Awesome. Upwards and onwards.